I'm Jennifer Walsh. I'm a composer and performer. I'm associate artist at Somerset House Studios. I'm here in Amsterdam at Sonic Acts Academy.
About the projects related to the fictional archive Ashtag. See, I'm getting there. Jennifer Walsh holds a PhD in composition from Northwestern University.
So I was performing with Mario de Vega on Friday night. I'm here giving a talk this Sunday, sitting in this industrial part of North Amsterdam, looking out over the water. The original sort of driver was Colin McAuliffe, who was the music curator for Cork Film Festival. And he sort of approached me and he just said, I really love this Ashtag project, this historical documents of the Irish avant-garde. He had seen the project online and he just said, I want to do something with it. And it was really fantastic because he just was saying to me, I don't know what we would do, but let's do something. And the concept I came up with was to make this film, with the idea being that one of the personae in Ashtag is Caoimhín Branach. And I've been claiming that he was my dead outsider artist great uncle since about 2011. And I've been exhibiting work from his archive since then. And so it felt quite natural to say, well, Caoimhín wanted to make this film. And I, as his great niece, you know, inheritor of his legacy, custodian of his archive, are going to realize the vision that was never realized. And that there's also a sense of like putting things right through that. So that was the concept, and Colm loved it. And he came up with this extra level, which was that originally the Cork Film Festival had commissioned it in the 80s, but the Archbishop of Cloyne had heard that it was going to be an occult ritual film and had, you know, censored it. So he felt it was also an institutional restitution, you know, of a commission that should have happened. I shot it all in around where my house is in Ireland, in Knockvicker, which is where I claim Caoimhín is from. And so really engaging with the landscape, but trying to do it in a slightly bent, weird way rather than the straightforward emerald-tinted, you know, glasses nostalgia, is just looking for weirdness in the landscape and then imposing my own, you know, my own little bit of weirdness there too. The idea of working with alter egos or personae is something that I've done for a long time. And I think most musicians have, in that even musicians who, you know, write classical pieces for orchestra, a lot of them were in bands when they were kids. So this idea that you have a formation maybe that you work in that has a name that's different to your own name, and that this formation maybe makes music that's a little bit different to this other formation, so it has a different name. That's very normal to me, the idea that like we don't make exactly the same music in different configurations. And so the idea of working with bands, I was in bands when I was a kid, having alter egos, you know, I started doing a lot of projects from 2007 on where I had this huge collective of alter egos that were all members of a sound art collective called Group Art. I really enjoyed the space that opened up and the way you could play, because it wasn't about fooling people. That wasn't the purpose. The whole purpose was to open up this sort of imaginative space where this could have happened. And for me, creatively, it was also to allow myself to try and think in these different ways, to try and put myself into different positions and make work that way. At the end of the commissioning period for this group art project, I sort of thought, oh, I'm done with that now. But one thing that kept coming back to me was these historical ideas, because all my alter egos had been alive. They were all born within 5 years of my birth year. And so I was starting to think, like, but what about history? And, you know, really trying to come to terms with my history as an Irish person at a point in time when, you know, the crash had happened. And you really feel like, you really, for my generation in particular, it was a very confusing period, because you grew up in a country where there was no immigration into the country and everybody was white Irish, as they say on the UK census, white Irish versus white, you know. And country's poor, everybody's immigrating, everybody's getting out. And then all of a sudden, very rapidly, you have this period where the country starts to make money, and not only does unemployment decrease, but it decreases to the point that people move to Ireland for work, which was the first time that ever happened in the history of the country. People started going back home. People who'd emigrated started going back home, and but also trying to rethink what it means to go back home when the country is completely shifted. You get a lot of immigration into the country, so the social makeup of the country shifts within a 10-year period in unbelievably rapidly. And that was, for a lot of Irish people, very strange. You have to think, it's one thing to say that we're a very leftist country who support all nations. That's one thing to say when it's a country that's just largely monocultural and made up of white people. But all of a sudden, when all of these people start moving in, how do you sort of reposition or think where you are in space? It was a, you know, change that would normally happen in 50 years happening in 10. And at that point, I'm looking back and I'm thinking, well, it's all very well. We've got these sushi bars and people are drinking lattes. And, you know, you're seeing kids walking down the street with designer handbags, which is something you never would have seen when I was growing up. But like, how do we reckon with the past? How do we look at what happened and try and move forward in a different way? And looking at Irish history and trying to see, you know, what was the experimental tradition? Of course, we have Flann O'Brien and Joyce and Beckett, and that they're very much held up, but was there stuff going on in music? And as I started to poke around, I was realizing, no, there's no data in Ireland. Why wasn't there data? We don't have like a real Irish Fluxus movement. There would have been artists who would sort of have done experimental things, but not really large enough to in a way that we would like attach that to the broader Fluxus movement. And so that made me go back, do research to try and think, are there things I've missed? I have to be careful to make sure what I was taught in school isn't necessarily the whole story. So you're trying to fill in these cracks that maybe were created by the educational system. And then sometimes you realize there are no cracks to fill. These things just didn't happen. You know, and so then you think, what if I try to invoke a point of contact with a parallel universe where these things really did happen? And that's how Ashdock was born. Buddy ain't for Mitch fast the gun I Mitch to Jerina Gilt to Erlor. Neil Troch the Gulko, Snor Jaglich is ne Winfrey Linga Bro. Ano to the Goniach than Javan. What I love about Ashdock is that it doesn't feel like it's my project. It feels like once I start talking about it with other people, they start to have ideas, and it really feels like a communal thing as a result. As I was working on the project, people would say, what are you working on? And I would tell them, and they'd say, oh my God, I'd love to write something. And I'd say, great, you know, contribute something, that would be brilliant. So along the way, I sort of collected these people. When I say collect, I don't mean that in a proprietorial sense, but I would meet Rob Kiley and he would say, oh, this is amazing. If you want, I'd love to write something. And I'm like, great, I've just met you and you're like an Irish PhD student who's writing about astrology in Beckett. Like, of course you should write something for this. So that was really great because it became this point of contact for ways to work with people you might not normally work with. And it's like a character universe, if that makes sense. Like, it was building a character universe and also building something which was much more diverse, you know, much more open. It's full of pain and awful. Like, there's all these horrible stories and people dying and being blinded and stuff. But there's a lot of grief in Ashdock about missed opportunities and chances that didn't happen and people emigrating because nobody understood their music or just dying in obscurity, which is really an effort to at least try and acknowledge the conditions, you know, that people were laboring under. But my sort of experience with it has been my entire family talk about Caoimhín Branach as if he's a real person. He's like just a relative, you know, as far as the family are concerned. And people will say things like, I saw this, it's really Caoimhín. You know, or, you know, that guy, we met him, he was cycling his bike in the dark and he told us there's a magnetic field on this road that means vans don't roll down the hill. You know, he's totally Caoimhín. So he's become an extra character within my family. When I made the piece, the plan was that Tony Conrad was going to come over. He was a very close collaborator of mine and he became ill and that wasn't possible. So there was a little bit of that sound in my head because I worked with Tony for a long time. But there's been a lot of different people who've done different versions of it. MC Schmidt, Nick Roth and Panos Geekas and myself, we did the premiere of it. But since then, I've done it in duos and trios and quartets, you know, with Mario De Vega on Friday night here. The previous performance before that was with George Lewis and Roscoe Mitchell, Tashi Nakamura and Martin Taxt, Lotte Anker and Simon Thomas. There's a huge list of people. And each time it's a little bit different. And people engage with the film in different ways. Some people, they watch it, but then during the performance, they don't want to watch it because they want to have this parallel thing going on. And some people stare at it, you know, the whole way through the performance. A sort of a very interesting hands-on approach to seeing how improvisers deal with film, whether they consider it the dominant aspect of the performance, or they consider it something that they're parallel to, and seeing all these different approaches. Each time it creates a different sort of space. It's usually a sort of a quite intense space, it feels, that we're in. In the case of myself and Mario, he has this mixer that he's worked with for years, but when you see it up close, it's broken, it's been retaped, parts of it are missing. So it feels like this quite strange ritualistic object that's been, you know, kept even though it's falling apart. And he has a lot of gadgets, like a deer hoof that has sensors in it that makes sound. And he'll also have objects that every now and then he might just throw an object on the floor, or little collections of tin cans or things like this. He has his field of activity that he's sort of negotiating, I think of it. And I feel like within that space, because he uses like lots of really super low frequencies, so often the space is very activated. You know, you sort of feel like your whole body all the bad stuff is being vibrated out of your body some of the time because it's very intense. What I enjoy about being in that space, musically or just sonically, there's this feeling that I'm tagging on to different things within his sound. And because what I'm very interested in doing with my voice is trying to do things I don't already do, because otherwise I'll just get bored. There's a huge amount of potential in what Mario, the feel that Mario creates, because I feel like I can mesh with things, I can imitate, I can tag on to things. And if you're a vocalist, or if you're an instrumentalist, that one of the real advantages that you have in a free improv situation is that you can react very immediately, you know, and so I can hear a pitch and just spit it back, you know, and start to interact very fast. Sometimes if you're playing no input mixer, it's difficult to hear a pitch and then figure out how to produce that pitch on the instrument, because the whole point is that you're wrestling with something that's unpredictable and that you don't know what's going on. When I did it with George Lewis and Roscoe Mitchell, it felt like Roscoe and I were engaged in the greatest battle. Like, you know, when you read these like seven novel epic fantasy novels where finally the two people have the duel, you know, that ends all duels and destroys half the village, and, you know, they die but then they come alive again because they remember advice they got from a sage. Like, that's what it felt like with Roscoe. Like, and we were both sweating and shaking by the end of it, and he just gave me the smile and the nod, like, you were an equal competitor, you know. And I was sort of like shaking afterwards. So for me, that's very, very interesting, because the intensity is still there, but it's in a different mode, you know. And when I've done it with other people, we've deliberately plotted out, okay, in this movement we'll all use tin whistles because it's like an Irish instrument, and it'll be like sort of hilarious but in an awful way because it's so dissonant, because we had every tin whistle in every tuning. People are playing two of them, so you hear this like wall of tin whistle, and it's just sort of strange and appalling. So I enjoy that very much. I think if it was going to develop, it would have to almost leap off the stage and become a ritualistic space, and the audience would have to be holding the, you know, the kidney from the sheep in their hands or something like that. This year, I have a big show that opens at the Model in Sligo, which is an Aistach show, and Anklecht will be one of the works that's shown there. And but like, we will do a live performance one night, but we'll show it in an installation space, but we'll have objects from the film like in the space, so people can sort of see it, can sort of see some of these objects up close. The objects that are used in the film, they're all from the Cuivian archive. So they all exist. They're all objects that have that I've associated with him since I've started using that, working with his personae. I'm sort of interested in how to keep expanding this Ashtach archive and what happens next. So one of the things I want to do for the show in the model is I want to do a holy water cocktail bar, because there's holy wells all over Ireland and they're really these pagan sites that have all these claims. Like, you go to St. Lazarus Well for cures for the eyes, you know, because that's specifically if you have eye problems. So I have this huge collection of holy water. Like, I had to climb up through brambles and ditches to just find a hole in the ground that nobody ever visits to fish the water out. I want to, like, specifically, you know, give you one that has a bit for your eyes, a bit for your kidneys, you know, a bit for your bad back, things like that. That's sort of where I'm thinking the universe of Ashtach being expanded.
I am the eternal music and an instrument of that music.
With the film, what was very interesting for me was it gave me a chance to sort of engage with people in the community around where I live in Knockvicker, where I live part-time. For example, there's one section in the film where we're firing clay, and this is sort of one of these ritualistic moments where clay is fired. You have to do it in a raku kiln, and you take it out, and it's like 800 degrees centigrade when it comes out, and it's glowing orange when it's first exposed. It's amazing. But you drop horsehair onto it, and the horsehair goes on fire for a split second and then carbonizes into the clay. And you end up with these very strange organic patterns that are caused by the horsehair. And it needs to be horsehair because it's so coarse that it actually stands a chance. We tried it with my dad's hair, you know, and it's not as thick. It just sort of becomes wispy and sort of makes a smudge, whereas the horsehair, it looks like these strange rivers meandering. And that, you know, was like a guy who grazes his horses in my field, you know, and I texted him, and he told me all about Ranyabu the horse, and then, you know, gave me this huge bag of horsehair. There's a scene in the film where there's a straw boy, which is this straw hat. People always say it looks very Blair Witch. For Irish people, it looks like Irish folk culture. So the straw boy, I needed to source one, and we were shooting in August, and that's the wrong time of year to get the right type of straw to make a straw boy. So I thinking, how am I going to get a straw boy? They're also a little complex to make. And I found Joe McGowan, this guy up at Mullach Moor, who, when I called him and said, I believe you might know somebody with a straw boy, he just said, I'll put it all in a bag and I'll leave it on my porch. I'm going out for a drive with the family. So I never met him, and I just drove to his house. There was a bin bag with a straw boy and the bandolier and this fantastic stuff, and I left some wine. Being able to say to people, I'm an artist, you've never heard of me, and I want to make this film, and I want to put a straw boy in the film. And they just go, oh, brilliant. I'll leave it on my porch for you. Because really, they're just happy that people are engaging with Irish folk culture in different ways. There's a scene in the film where we go to a holy well, we go to Tobernault. There's a tradition within Irish holy wells that there's a rag tree. And the idea is that if you say you want to give up smoking, so you tie a little bit of cloth to the rag tree, which is a living tree, you know, and the idea is that when the cloth rots away, your wish will come true or your prayer will be granted and you'll give up smoking. You know, American tourists would be horrified. They'd round a corner to what they think is going to be this beautiful pagan/Christian ancient holy well. And there was a tree that's just covered in trash because people drive there and then they go, oh, I want to make a wish on the rag tree. What have we got to tie on it? There's crisp packets. There's tights, like nylon tights that are never going to rot away. That prayer will never be granted. And particularly in recent years, earbuds. So people have, you know, cheap €4 earbud headphones in the car. So they tie these around the rag tree. So I had these cassettes that Cuivin had made with this St. Bridget's Cross rushes wrapped around them. And the idea was that, you know, he places these at the holy wells and that these are his sort of sacred sounds, that he's taken this St. Bridget's Cross, which is what we did in school on the 1st of February each year. We actually wove St. Bridget's crosses from rushes. And so that's on the cassette and it's hanging from the holy well. But I go there and people think I staged it because there's so much weird crap on the tree. And I'm like, no, I didn't do anything. All I did was hang the cassette, and it sort of fades in because there's like multiple headphones hanging from this tree. For me, it was looking for those things and just sort of adding my layer. Because I suppose, if I can say this, Irish people use holy wells flexibly. people who have no faith at all, and who left Catholicism years ago and would never describe themselves even as Christian, will go to Holywell and just sort of use it as a moment to just sort of think about people they love. People use it very flexibly, you know, in whatever way that they want. And that for me to go there and intervene in it and use it as a sort of artistic imaginary space makes total sense. Nobody has ever said to me, oh, this is blasphemous or it's disrespectful, because everybody else is driving up and leaving their cigarettes and tying a kettle chips packet around the tree, you know, not because they believe in Christianity, but simply because they really want to give up smoking. I came to Sonic Acts last year. That was my first time at the festival. And I came with Arditi Quartet and we did my piece, Everything is Important. And then I also did a solo set. I love the fact that it's not predominantly a sound festival. It's really a festival about ideas and about thinking about things. It was also interesting in that I thought, like, okay, you can take these different sort of parts of the broad, new, experimental / free improv world and mesh them together. And people do appreciate the sort of the difference. So the Sonic Acts Academy is different because of the idea to say, well, let's try and think about different ways that we can talk about learning with students. And it's coming from people. It's not driven initially by university. It's driven by people who just think this is important to do. There's still the progress bar nights.
Stop the lights! Stop the lights, Dottie!